Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, which is one of the many podcast channels that you can find on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Hotkin. I'm one of the hosts of the New Books in Folklore channel. And today my guest is William G. Pooley. Will, as I'm going to call him, is a folklore-friendly historian based at the University of Bristol in the UK, who'll be talking about his first book, Body and Tradition in 19th Century France, Félix Arnaudin and the Moorlands of Gascony, 1870 to 1914. Will Pooley, welcome to the New Books in Folklore podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And did I say that title right, or at least the words in it that are foreign to me, Félix Arnaudin?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
Okay, great. So I'm going to start, before we get to the book, by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps how you came to be interested in folklore.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I started out being interested in history. I was kind of interested in those kinds of history of people who don't necessarily have access to writing, the kinds of people that it's harder to write history about in general. And it was actually your brother, Rachel, David Hopkin, who I think you've interviewed on this series before. And he was the one who introduced me to kind of folklore as a topic that could be of interest from that point of view. So when I was a master's student, a long time ago, it feels now, he suggested to me that I do a project based on some folklore. And I did that for my master's. And then on the back of that, I then ended up going to America to study folklore at Utah State for a year on the Five Folklore Fellowship. And then I came back and I did a PhD with David Hopkin on folklore and history.
I love it. My brother is corrupting the world of historians to come to their senses and find folklore fascinating, which it sounds like you did.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for me, it offered some of the things that I'm interested in history in terms of, you know, real people kind of getting to grips with the experiences of ordinary people in the past, their emotions, their relationships to other people. And that kind of folklore material was definitely, it was the best stuff that I'd ever done as a historian. So I've stuck with it.
So this book is based upon the collection of a folklorist. Can you tell us about who Félix Arnaudin was and why his collection was of interest to you?
Sure. So when I started out, I was originally going to do a project which was about three folklorists who were all from the same region, kind of big region of southwestern France. And there's a linguistic region there. So people in general who speak the Gascon dialects of the Occ language. And so Arnaudin was one of the three. And the other two, I've worked a bit on Jean-François Bladet and another interesting anarchist adjacent folklorist called Antonin Pierre-Bosque, all collecting folklore across kind of the 19th and early 20th centuries. And what actually happened was that when I first went to look in the archives of the Arnaudin materials, I realized that I was never going to have time to do anything beyond just getting to grips with Arnaudin's collection. He was a really meticulous, very thorough folklorist. He collected hundreds of songs, a large number of oral narratives, depending on how you count them in the manuscripts, because of course some of them are very fragmentary. And and he also collected a lot of dialect speech. There are kilometers of microfilms of his original manuscripts in the archives in southwestern France. But the kind of the tragic thing about him, I guess, is that although he did all of this folklore collecting between about 1870 and 1914, he really didn't publish much of it. So during his own lifetime, he hardly saw any of it in print. He was a perfectionist, and he just never managed to finalize those publications, which is something that I definitely try not to identify with her too much.
You write about him in the first chapter, and he sounds like quite a poignant character. Can you tell us a little bit more about his background and his personal life?
So he's a very he you know, I didn't put this in the book, but I think it's safe to say it here on the podcast. I have very ambivalent feelings about him because in a sense, he provided all this material, which has then been the basis for the entire book. And it's an incredible, incredible archive of material. But I wouldn't say that I am particularly fond of him as you know, his personality. He felt like a failure in life. And he had a very strange relationship to his kind of family and to his local community and society, because he was the son of the mayor of the town where he lived, and he was related to various other kind of local dignitaries. So he was, you know, when he was young, a teenager and in his 20s, people assumed that he would maybe go into the law, or he'd go into politics like other family members had, or he'd make money like a lot of other people did through local business and the expansion of the forest in the region. But he didn't, he spent his entire life doing this kind of folklore collecting and photography, and kind of by the time he died, he'd spent all of his family money, and he'd never kind of left the region. He never kind of came to terms with what it was that he thought he was doing, in a sense. And he also has this very problematic relationship with the family maid, which is, it's a complicated story in a sense, because in one sense it's not complicated. He was in his 30s and she was 14 when they first started their relationship, and then his family found out, and when the family found out, she was sent away, and then she clearly tried to kill herself. And then at some point, after his mother died, she came back to live with him, and they lived together until she died, kind of 20 or 30 years later. So there's a lot going on, I think, with that particular relationship in particular, and in the materials that he left as well, it's clear that he had relationships with other women. It's impossible to identify them because he anonymized them in the manuscripts, but there's definitely a lot of different things going on in his personality, and not all of it is very endearing, to be honest.
Right. And so how did he go about collecting this folklore collection that you built your dissertation and now this book upon?
So Arnodin quite clearly fits into this kind of like newer school of folklorists in France, and I think across Europe there are similar patterns, but he's in this kind of newer school in the later 19th century who are really serious about kind of ethnographic methods. And so the kind of things that involves, he really wants to make sure that he's writing down oral traditions as close to the way that they're spoken as possible, or as close to the way they're sung. So that means for him capturing dialect, which he's very interested in. And it also means recording as many variants as possible, especially with the songs. So he would produce these wonderful he's got these big notebooks, and on the page, it would have a version of the song collected from one person, and then all over the rest of the page he's noted how different singers sang different versions. So if they were very similar, he wouldn't write out the whole song, he'd just say, you know, the same as this other version, except they've changed the words here and they've changed the words there. So he was very meticulous like that, and he was also meticulous in the sense of wanting to preserve the identities of his singers and storytellers and other informants, although he had some ambivalences around whose identities he was willing to preserve. He did in general want to kind of make it clear who he'd collected the material from. And then I think the other important thing to know about him is that he is a native speaker of the Gascon dialect that he collected most of his material. Most of the folklore he collected was in this Gascon dialect. So he was a native speaker. He was a kind of native son, if you like, of the region. And he felt very fiercely defensive and proud of that local culture. And it was definitely a culture that he was himself an active participant in. You know, his family, although they were kind of a local dignitaries, they'd risen quite quickly from the local artisan class, if you like. And he didn't feel distant, I suppose, from a lot of the people that acted as informants, even if perhaps he was more distant than he was willing to recognize.
Right. So this region of France, Gascony, is a really important character in the book. Can you tell me about the region and why you found it so fascinating?
So, yeah. So Gascony covers quite a large part of southwestern France, and probably anyone out there who's ever been there as a tourist might associate it with kind of foie gras, There's a lot of rich duck-based food and those kind of things, and wine as well. There's some wonderful wine. But in particular, this one sub-region of that larger region where Arnadan collected folklore is called the Moorlands of Gascony, or the Landes de Gascogne in French. And they were moorlands at the start of the 19th century. But by the period that Arnadan was collecting this folklore, most of the moorland had been forested. And this was a really, really big change in the region. The forest which was planted on those moorlands is still the largest man-made forest in Europe. And it was that forest was, in a sense, imposed onto the region by the national government. They passed a national law encouraging local communities to sell off the communally held moorlands to private investors. And then private investors were expected to drain and plant the moorlands with pine trees, because from the point of view of the national government, certainly, and reformers have been saying this for a long time, the region was very sterile. It's extremely hard to grow food there. Most of the people who lived there subsisted by kind of combining sheep farming with hunting and fishing and some pine farming. And the government felt that turning the whole region into pine trees was a much better use of the region, because the trees could be sapped for resin, and that resin had a lot of uses in early industry, especially before the advent of plastics. The resin could be made into various products.
Am I right in understanding that this area was seen as kind of rather backwards, in need of intervention by more educated, more sophisticated peoples? That's kind of the impression I got.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I should have talked about that. I suppose that's the really interesting stuff, is that outside visitors talk about the region before forestation as being this, it's like the Sahara Desert within France, or it's like, you know, they compare it to foreign territories that have been colonized, and the people who live there are more savage than, you know, than any of the populations of various parts of the world that France had in fact colonized. And there is definitely a romanticism and a kind of, you know, a romanticism of misery and a kind of an exaggeration perhaps of how extreme that situation was, but that's certainly how it was seen by outsiders.
I was wondering if there was kind of parallel between there and the Southern Appalachian Mountains in the United States. Is that something you can comment on, or is that outside of your area?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, you know, there are obvious differences in terms of the histories of those populations, but I think in terms of the way that the region is both presented as being very primitive and, you know, almost barbaric, but also kind of culturally pure and very important for how people think about the preservation of traditions. So it's often mentioned actually in the 19th century as being one of the regions that preserves witchcraft traditions longer than other regions, which actually, I don't think is true based on subsequent research, but that's, you know, that's how it's seen by outsiders as a kind of fascinating and interesting cultural place.
Arnaudin was collecting between 1870 and 1914. Who was he collecting from, and what kinds of things did he focus on in his collections? This is the subject of one of your chapters.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, in chapter 3, I talk a lot about who these informants that Arnaudin collected folklore from actually were, because there's an interesting question about how honest folklorists in the 19th century were about who they were collecting folklore from. And there's, you know, actually there's been some very interesting work on the English folklorists from this point of view, because Arnaudin, much like English folklorists, tends to emphasize that his folklore informants are old. He tends to emphasize that they do traditional occupations. So for him, it's really important that he, you know, he's saying that he collects a lot of material from shepherds, because the shepherds are the, you know, that's the traditional occupation of people living in the region. And he's also actually very interested in emphasizing the importance of women to some forms of his folklore collecting, so particularly singing. Now, I was skeptical of that, and I thought that what I would do is I would go and do some research in the archives and see if that was true. And what I didn't really think about carefully enough in advance, looking back in retrospect, is how difficult it is to do that kind of research. I spent a lot of time looking at birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates, wills, you know, military records, marriage contracts, all these kind of things, and trying to piece together what Arnodin said in his manuscript about these people with what I could prove based on other sources.
Wow, that's a lot of research.
It did, yeah. I think I would. I've met other people who said, "Oh, I'd like to try this with," and I normally say to them, "It's maybe more work than it's worth." Sometimes I think perhaps what I wish I'd done was focused on the individuals I thought were really important and done that work for them.
You said there were 750. You think there were 759 informants in the manuscript? You weren't looking up the births and deaths of everyone, were you?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, but I mean, I was looking for 750 possible different individuals, because sometimes Arnodin used different names for the same person, because sometimes he might refer to them, a woman especially, by her married name or by her maiden name. And sometimes he used nicknames. So it can be hard to know if all 750 different people. But I didn't manage to find all 750. I think in the end I only positively identified about 400. But it was still, that was a lot of work. I think really complicated also by the language question, because most of those people speak Gascon as their first language. A lot of them, I mean, almost all of them, I think, would have been fluent in French as well. But the fact that Gascon was the language of everyday life means that they don't use French names in everyday life. So they might be christened Jean-François, but when they get married, their name on the marriage certificate is down as Pierre, because no one ever calls them Jean-François, because that's not a Gascon right. name. They've probably got a Gascon nickname or a Gascon alternative.
Oh, so was part of this that you had to learn a new dialect as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I learned Gascon by reading Arnodin's writings. So I didn't. It's not like I actually undertook proper language classes. I think it probably wouldn't have helped me to do that anyway, because he wrote a very idiosyncratic version of the language, because he was the first person actually to try and write it, to write that modern dialect of Gascon, I should say. There are obviously there are medieval writings in Gascon as well, and there are modern Gascons now as well. But when he was doing this, he tried to codify his local dialect, so it'd be very hard to read based on learning modern Gascon.
How similar is it to the French that you would learn in a British or an American classroom?
It is similar. You can certainly, I mean, I think the thing I would say is it's as similar to French as it is to Spanish and maybe Italian, you know, those Romance languages, there's a lot of vocabulary overlap. And once you know the rules of kind of, there are some very obvious rules. So like B's become V's, much like with Spanish. And once you begin to recognize that, it's easier to, you can basically just kind of, one could even write a small piece of software that basically just took some bits of Gascon and automatically changed certain letters, and you'd have something that a French speaker would recognize.
So your first three chapters in the book are setting up the context and the main characters and the region and the informants. And then you move on to the body of the text, which, no pun intended, is about the body. So what made you interested in the body, and how has that been viewed in history? In the introduction, you talk about a modernizing of the body. Can you tell us a little bit about the whole kind of approach to the body in the works of historians and the attitudes of historians?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one of the things that I've always been really interested in and continue to be interested in is this, you know, I think there's this basic point, which a lot of historians would now agree with, which is that even the most fundamental elements of kind of like human experience are historically changeable. So I was really interested in the fact that where maybe 20, 30 years ago, historians who are writing about the body, they might write about how representations of the body have changed over time, so that bodies are depicted in different ways, you know, through art or through literature or something like that. But I'm much more interested in the idea that bodies might literally be different. So people might feel differently, they might hold their bodies differently, they might use them differently, and they might understand them in such fundamentally different ways that calling that a kind of representation doesn't really do justice to the kind of radical difference of how they're experiencing their bodies. So that's very much where I was coming from as a historian. And I think the book is an attempt to to show some of that working, which is it's very hard to do. You have to somehow balance between telling the stories of individual people and explaining how they relate to their bodies, and then at the same time draw back, I think, to show what that's got to do with a general sense of this process which you've referred to, that some historians have talked about as the modernization of the body, the idea that over the last few hundred years, or whatever chronology you want to choose, that the body has somehow become sealed in, that we've become a modern self that's divided from the cosmos, that we that we think in these very Cartesian terms that separate out a mind from a body, and maybe a soul from the mind from the body, which is a narrative that I have to say that I'm skeptical of, and I think that one of the things that makes folklore so fascinating is that it's got this richness of material to suggest other stories, other narratives of how people's relationships to the body have changed.
So when you came to this collection, actually, just before I get to that, how did you come to this collection? Is it in a building in one place, or is it online, or how did you access the materials?
That's a good question. So the materials are actually available in several different forms. Before I started the PhD, just a few years before, they finished the complete works of Arne Dahn's writings. But I think, the thing to say, so this complete works was based on his manuscripts, and those manuscripts are all housed in the same archives, which are in Mont-de-Marsan in southwestern France. And that was actually, those manuscripts were, some of them were dispersed on his death. The stories that actually they were kind of, some of them were thrown away, and they were rescued from the bin by people who knew that their value, but they were reassembled over the 20th century. And they're all held in Mont-de-Marsan. And then in the late 20th century and into the 21st century, there was this big project which brought together a whole team of scholars to edit those manuscripts and make them into an edited collection. But of course, they couldn't include everything. And in particular, I think there's a reluctance to include stuff that was fragmentary. So it was much easier to include the narratives that were whole narratives that Arne Dahn had already written up, ready for publication, for instance. Or the same with the songs, where he'd really laboriously laid out how he thought the songs should be presented. He just hadn't finished getting them to publication. Whereas there are some other materials, especially kind of basically short ethnographic notes, that it was very hard for the editors of that edited collection to put into the edited collection.
Although I think you find some of those kind of more scrappy parts of his collection kind of interesting, precisely because they weren't so polished. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I think I think one of the things that is interesting about manuscript folklore collections compared to published collections is that very often you do get this sense of materials that are more, I think, dialogic. So those scraps are very often because they're taken from conversation. So you get more of a sense of where these things are happening. You also get a sense, I think, of those ambiguities. So the scrappy materials are often the things where people are unsure, or they're involved in conversation. And that's, for the topics I've been talking about, where you're trying to think about, what do people think about their own bodies? That can be much more valuable, I think, than a really polished performance story.
Right. Actually, as a further aside, one of the things I liked in this book was how you're pointing out his frustration with some of his informants. It's like, this woman seemed to change the whole song on a whim and last moment. It's like...
Yeah. And it's really interesting as well, because I think, I'm grateful. I am very grateful to Arne Dahn when he writes things like that, because if he didn't include those notes about his own opinion in the manuscripts, then he, his role in shaping them would be harder, I think, to disentangle. And it's so great that he's like, oh, I don't like it when they do this, or he clearly disapproves of some of the material, and he records that sometimes. And that's really helpful to me, because it shows me exactly how he's shaping it as a folklorist.
So as you came to this collection, how did you start pulling out bits specifically concerned with the body? Were you literally looking for words related to the body?
I think, to be honest, I took the approach of just trying to look at everything and decide what I thought was most interesting. I think I knew from the start that I wanted to focus on individual performers in some of the chapters. So I was on the lookout for performers who I found the most interesting, which is how I've ended up with most of the individuals who have a whole chapter each. But in terms of looking for the body stuff, it was really a process of, I was going through all of the microfilms. So I went through everything I think they have from Arne Dahn's manuscripts, and looking for things that I thought would help me to piece something together about this.
And so what kinds of themes related to the body emerged during this research?
So I think there's a lot of stuff in the book about work, which I don't think should be surprising. Almost all of the informants that Arne Dahn really valued were manual workers, whether that's kind of agricultural work. A lot of the agricultural work actually in the region is done by women. And, you know, all women do huge amounts of domestic work, or did huge amounts of domestic work at the time. So work is perhaps the dominant theme. And in a sense, it's so loud that it kind of sometimes it drowns everything else out. And sometimes it can be about looking for the other things that people talk about. I think the other obvious theme, which I dwell a lot on in the book, is sexuality. And there's a lot of material in the archive about how people talked about their sexual bodies and how they negotiated that. I think sometimes it's a lot more direct than people who are unfamiliar with manuscript folklore collections might assume for this period.
I was a bit surprised by it. We'll come to that in a little bit because you focus on But I like the way that you describe the approach to the body in this folklore. It's, you'd call it pointillist, I think. And it's sort of legs, feet, teeth, lips, eyes, and arses.
Yeah. And so that's the other thing. And I wanted to give this picture of, you know, what body do you get if you just look for the words, what body parts do people focus on? And like you say, it's a strangely pointillist kind of body. It's also very focused on the lower half of the body, which I think is really interesting and important. You know, there's a lot of stuff about legs and a lot of stuff about buttocks, which I think there's a lot to unpick there, which can be quite hard without being able to talk to these people directly. What do you mean when you're constantly talking about this?
And some of it is just about how exhausted people are. But you also say that although there's little discussion of beauty, beauty of legs does come up.
Yeah. So I think the focus on the legs is so extreme that even, you know, it's not just about work. It's legs seem to be the kind of most prized body part. I think there's really a sense that everyone feels their body is kind of pulled down to the ground by gravity. So I talk about this quite a lot. You know, it's stooped. It's bent over like a sickle. Exhausted from work. And that's actually, you know, there is a long prehistory, if you like, of that attitude to the body. There's some really nice work from early modern historians on the fact that being able to stand upright is really a kind of, you know, it's an elite privilege, and people who do a lot of manual labor, they're constantly feeling like their gravity is the main kind of dominating force in their life.
That brings us nicely on to chapter 5, which is headed Monstrous Bodies. Tell us about this chapter, which is centered on a werewolf legend by a woman called Mary Shumbuzas. I'm sure I haven't said that right.
So actually, this is a really good example of what I was talking about in terms of, it's very difficult to identify for sure, for certain, who the individuals that Arne Dahn collected materials from were. And I've said in the book that this story is told by Mary Shumbuzas, and I think that's right. Unfortunately, in the edited works, the kind of full edited works, they attribute the story to someone else because they think that Mary Shumbuzas is the same woman as another woman named Marianne de Marie-Allon. And I spent a lot of time on this, and I'm pretty sure they're different people. And actually, the differences in their lives are quite instructive. So this is one of the chapters where I do focus on an individual, and there are other chapters where I tend to kind of more look at a broader picture of local culture. And in this chapter, I was particularly interested because Mary Shun is an unusual storyteller. It's the story she's telling. She tells several stories about witchcraft, but she also tells several stories about werewolves, and that makes her quite unusual. There are not actually that many recorded werewolf stories from across the whole of France in this period, and there are very, very, very few which are kind of first-hand, you know, memorat or kind of second-hand legend stories where, you know, friend of a friend style stories, which is what Mary Shun tells. One of the stories she tells, and which I dwell on here, is actually a recollection from her childhood. So that makes her, I think, a really interesting storyteller. But I wanted to kind of talk about her in the context of other werewolf stories. So I tried to find all the werewolf stories I could from 19th century France and get a picture of like what werewolf stories in general are about. And in the chapter, I talk about the fact that, in fact, you know, these stories aren't very violent. They're not at all like the kind of Hollywood image of werewolf legends. They're not necessarily even very scary. They're something closer to kind of disgust. They're unsettling stories, and they very rarely feature wolves. So yeah, they're not wolves. Even when people, storytellers, I think Mary Shune, she uses the Gascon words, you know, loup-garou, basically werewolf, but they are not wolves. They're dogs. They're very clearly in the story people who turn into dogs. And in other regions, you know, you quite often get people who turn into other domestic animals. So cats is very common as well, sheep, goats, pretty much any domestic animal. But they still use words like loup-garou. They use the words werewolf, or, you know, there are lots of different dialect terms, which some of which don't use the word wolf, but they're clearly all referring to a similar phenomena, and it's not necessarily wolves.
What conclusions did you come to based on Mary Shune's stories about wolves or dogs?
So the kind of conclusion I drove towards, based on my identification of who she is, so she's a woman who grows up in a fairly traditional, I should probably, you know, quote unquote traditional family in the region. So a large family living in one of these large houses where she would have shared the house with family members, extended family, and also perhaps other people who worked for the family and sharecroppers. But she makes the transition from that kind of in her youth to living, when she dies, she's living on her own in a small house in the town. And that's after all of these changes have happened to the landscape. And one of the things that I'm interested in and I talk about in the chapter is that, so she tells this story and, you know, the point of the story ostensibly is to say, I had this incredible experience. I saw a werewolf when I was a child. But actually, if you look at the details of what the story dwells on, it dwells on her extended family. It dwells on their household. It dwells on the boundaries of that kind of community. And my reading of the story is that the reason that it's so important to Mary Shune, you know, it's a personal experience. I'd argue there's some kind of symbolic work going on there around her own transition from living in that traditional family to living on her own as an older woman after all of these changes have happened to the region. And those traditional family forms are a lot less common. There's a lot of material about how community has become more kind of fragmented and isolated. So for me, you know, although we're drawn to the werewolf itself, this monster in the story, that she's using that bodily transformation to talk about, you know, the transformation of her own community.
The next chapter, chapter 6, is one of the ones where you're focusing on a number of different informants. And this one's called Singing Love, and it's about attitudes to love and sex as demonstrated in the folklore. Needless to say, I thoroughly enjoyed this chapter.
Yeah, it's fun, isn't it? And I think the important thing is that the songs do seem to embody a kind of feminine culture, so that they aren't uniquely sung by women, but it does seem that more of them were sung by women than by men. So they are definitely, in a sense, they're definitely more focused on women's concerns than they are on men's concerns. And they're also, as I think we've already mentioned, that they're incredibly bawdy. So there's a lot of kind of directly erotic material, or you know, references that are very clear references to sex, which I think might surprise people who weren't familiar with the actual contents of those manuscript collections.
You start the chapter by talking about how many of the women dressed in dull colours traditionally, but often the songs describe their yearning to wear bright clothes, and you relate this to a yearning for sexual liberation, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's a kind of... So I would be careful about how much I believe this narrative, but there's definitely a kind of implied narrative in a lot of the songs that sexual culture used to be freer, that women had more power to do what they wanted with their bodies, and that there has been a kind of tightening of sexual morality within living memory. And I think it is really hard to say whether that's something that really happened or whether it's a kind of narrative device that's common to a lot of the songs. But it does map on to the singers a bit as well. So in the chapter, I talk about individual singers and how they adopt that trope to their own life circumstances. So women who, you know, who who did need to marry in order to preserve their family farm, for instance, or women who did not conform to kind of local expectations about marriage and sexuality. And it's definitely, yeah, it's linked to the clothing. So there seems to be a general pattern actually towards wearing more sober clothing, so darker clothing, black clothing. And there is a lot of material in the songs about women desiring to wear, yeah, the color red in particular, which is seen as a color of youth and marriage.
And you're talking about also how they like to sing about carefree love before or outside of marriage. And very few songs are about the honour of young women, which is interesting because quite a lot of the folk songs I'm very familiar with are often about young women being defiled and left in desperate situations and, you know, coming to a tragic end because of that. But that seems to be a less of a focus here.
Yeah, I'd say it definitely is less of a focus. I mean, there are definitely examples, and particularly in the following chapter, I talk about a bit about one of the women who had more of an interest in that kind of tradition. But I mean, I think the other key thing to say about that is that there seems to be very little interest in Catholicism. And I think that definitely influences the kind of the tone of the songs as well. They were the kind of songs that local priests did not like people to sing. And, you know, in general, local priests therefore are hostile to singing and folk singing in particular.
So all this kind of bawdiness and expression about, you know, carefree love, it seems to be at odds with your conclusion then, which is that this was a period of repression of female sexuality in the Moorlands, which stands in marked contrast to what historians of sexuality have said about the increasing liberalisation of sex in France during this period. So I was curious as to how you came to that conclusion.
So this is the point about the fact that a lot of the singers sing nostalgically about bawdy themes, and they sing about it in a way that that explicitly explains that they feel that kind of sexual freedom is no longer the norm. So there's quite a lot of stuff about the kind of the threat of gossip. So, you know, I think there's one singer in particular I dwell on in the chapter who seems to have a real kind of, I don't know what the right word for it is, but she's very concerned, shall we say, about the rise of gossip and the damage that it does to women's ability to kind of, I think, to circumvent some of the public conventions about the relationship between sex and marriage. So the conclusion I'm making here is, and I do think you have to take it with a pinch of salt in the sense that these songs are all collected in the 1870 to 1914 period. And the women, it seems to me, are suggesting that their sexual freedoms have been curtailed within living memory. But that is, you know, I think we have to understand that as a performance. So I wouldn't say that it's a kind of fail-safe guide to what actually happened to sexual relations over the period. Yeah.
Right. Interesting. And then we go from that subject to the subject of silence and chastity. That's the title of chapter 7, in which you move on to, a single informant by the name of Catherine Jeant. Who was she? Tell us why she was of interest to you.
So I first became interested in Catherine Jeant because she is one of Arnaudin's most prolific singers. So she's very, very important in the manuscript. She sings a lot of songs. And he does this thing with her songs, which he does do with other informants as well, but it's really obvious with Catherine's, I think, which is that he records when she doesn't know a song. And he uses her to verify other people's songs. So if he has a version of a song from another woman, he might write next to it, "Catherine doesn't know this one," or most often he just write "Catherine, non," you know, "no" from Catherine. So I was really interested in what that kind of omission or silence or refusal to sing, whether there was any pattern to those absences. So as with other chapters, I focused in on who Catherine is, and she's a youngish woman, so I think she's in her 30s when she meets Arnaudin, although I would have to go back to my notes to check that. But she's a seamstress, and that's a very specific role in rural society, and it is one, you know, there are implications of kind of seamstresses are associated with sexually licentious behavior because they go into lots of different people's houses and they touch people's bodies. And, you know, they have this relationship with cloth and the body, which is more intimate than most respectable women would be expected to. And they're also, they have, seamstresses have this kind of cultural responsibility for passing on female practices to young girls. So there's a kind of tight cultural knot of expectations around seamstresses and sexuality. She's also someone who's recorded as having a physical disability in the census. And that physical disability, the census suggests that she has a limp. And again, believe it or not, there's a kind of a very strong association between limping and sexuality in other materials that aren't then collected. So there are kind of there's a very overt sexualization of women who limp in the materials. So that's the kind of, that's what I know about Catherine from looking at these other sources. And then when you look at the songs she refuses to sing, it's all of the songs about sex, and she leaves out a lot of the bawdy material that other singers put in. And so you've got this kind of fascinating picture of someone who, there are clear cultural expectations that she's sexually available, sexually promiscuous, but she, as a singer, is deliberately, deliberately or unconsciously, she rejects those kind of associations.
Yeah, it's fascinating. She's creating a kind of persona that is, seems to be rejecting all of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose I wish I'd put more in that chapter actually about, I think I do discuss it, but you know, if we're coming back to Anadan, had this, I think he does have a problematic relationship with his female singers. I don't know if he had relationships with more than one of his female singers. It does seem likely. There are kind of hints in the manuscripts. So it may be that what we're seeing, particularly with this example, is her reaction against, you know, maybe this is her way of trying to fend off unwanted advances from the folklorist. It's very hard to say.
Right. Yeah, no, but it's an interesting idea. And then in the final chapter, it's about exploited bodies. It's based on tales about foxes, and it begins with one told by a man. It's actually a very sad little story about this fox's, who is kind of, as you call him, a hapless anti-hero. This fox's attempts to outwit or at least get something from the farmer and failing every time until eventually he and Mrs. Fox leave and then drown.
Yeah, it's a very dark story. And again, I think if, you know, if you were only familiar with animal tales from some of the more, how shall I say, some of the cleaned up versions that folklorists have published at different times, then you might not be aware of the violence, and the depressing, very depressing outlook and endings to many of these stories. Of course, you know, that's actually a tradition that has a lot in common with similar animal story traditions in America, I guess. You know, there's a lot of parallels there to be drawn with traditions collected about, you know, the violence of relationships in animal tales in America.
Right, and you talk about these fox tales mostly in relation to the practice of sharecropping. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were able to discern about the sharecroppers' attitudes to their situation from these tales that they were telling?
So the way that sharecropping works is that the tenants of a farm agree to give normally half of the product of that farm to the landlord. And in exchange, obviously, the landlord is providing the farm, and the landlord will very often also provide some tools. They might even provide seed. There are various other kind of responsibilities that might fall to the landlord. But it's an extremely exploitative system, and it's got a reputation amongst agricultural theorists and historians. It's for basically being the system that you use when you want to exploit a working population as effectively as possible, and especially where agricultural conditions are very difficult. And that is the case in these moorlands of Gascony where Anadan was collecting folklore. And so the consequences of this kind of system are that everything about your family life, if you like, is wrapped up in a struggle to kind of to make it good to your landlord. So your whole family is going to have to pull together and in order to just provide the things that you need to provide the landlord. So it might not just be half of your grain crop at the end of the year, but it might also be a few of your chickens every now and then. It might be a few sheep every now and then, and things like this. So it's clearly an emotionally very draining system for the people working in it, and physically draining as well. And for me, that's the way to understand this story. The story is told by a man named Henri Vidal, and he grows up in a kind of traditional family. I think some of his family members are artisans, and some of them are listed as farmers or sharecroppers at various points, and that's his background. But by the time he dies, which I think he dies after, I can't remember if he dies after Anadan or around the same time, but by that point he's actually become a clerk, and he's probably something closer to a friend of Anadan than to, you know, a straightforward folklore informant. So in the chapter, I suggest that he's made this transition from being part of this exploited sharecropper class to being, you know, not well paid, but a bit more independent, better educated, and he's kind of escaped from that system. And so the story, I think, is really interesting from that point of view, because it really dwells on the violence and the problems of that sharecropping system. So in the story, the relationship between the fox and the farmer is very clearly similar to the relationship between a sharecropper and a landlord. So the farmer in the story has control over the fox's house. He offers him this set where he and his wife can go and live, but it turns out that the set is useless and it's not fit for purpose for living in. And that's, you know, the kind of complaints you often get from sharecroppers. They're being provided with unsuitable accommodation, so they can't do their work, so they've got nowhere to live. And he also, they're fighting over food the whole time, which again, that's key to the relationship between a sharecropper and a farmer. So I thought Henri was a really interesting case of, like, here's someone who is actually, he's so angry about the system. He does something in his own life and he ends up not working as a sharecropper anymore. And I think you have to set that kind of experience alongside other different experiences. So in the chapter, I compare him to other people who Anadan collected a lot of material from, who remained sharecroppers for their whole lives, and in fact were sharecroppers for the Anadan family. And so in that case, what you find, you don't see so much anger in the stories, and you don't see that kind of, you see the same extremely violent relationship between the different animals in the stories, but those sharecroppers tend to tell stories about donkeys, and these donkeys are extremely faithful, and they'd never disobey their master. And, you know, even though they've been horribly abused, don't worry, they're still faithful. So I, you know, in the chapter, I'm making a fairly clear point. I think that's about people's individual life choices, or what, you know, what they have to do to survive, essentially.
One of the things I should mention is that Anadan, you point out, is a photographer as well as a collector of narratives and songs. Can you tell us a little bit about the photographs that he took, some of which actually feature in the book, which is lovely?
Yes, I mean, I think, to be honest, there'll be a large number of people who acquire the book purely on the basis of the photographs. There aren't that many of them, but it can be quite hard to get reproductions of Anadan photographs, in fact. But he's actually, in a sense, he's one of the earlier, I mean, I don't want to say earliest, I'm not hugely well informed about it, but he's a very early ethnographic photographer. You know, he starts taking photographs of local people and in particular costume. You know, he's very interested in clothing in the 1870s. Over his life, he does take hundreds of these huge glass plate photographs, which are still in the museum in Bordeaux. And so the photographs, yeah, they are focused. He does a lot of portraits of local people in traditional costume, but he also does a huge number of photos of the landscape. Those photos of the landscape are really for him about kind of reclaiming a vision of the landscape before forestation. So again, in the same way as perhaps a lot of his folklore collecting was about reconstructing a culture that he thought had been destroyed by forestation, he uses the photography to recreate this landscape that he feels is destroyed by forestation. But they're absolutely beautiful photographs. I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, they look even better when they're huge. I've seen in a few restaurants in the region there, they have large reproductions of Anadan photographs, and they're very panoramic. You know, he was fascinated by the horizon.
Yeah, they seem to also just be technically very good. I mean, they could have been taken much more recently than when he was working.
Yeah, he uses some interesting techniques, actually. He he spent most of his money on photographic equipment. That's how he that's really how he squanders the family money. Yeah, and he used some interesting techniques, including, so there's a really good photo of a veye, you know, a spinning bee, where people are meant to be singing and telling stories, and he's got these women with their spindles, and it's a wonderful photo. But of course, he didn't have a flash or any way of taking photos indoors. So looking through the notes, and some of the local photographic historians worked this out, he arranged with these women to go to this abandoned building in the middle of the moorland, which had no roof, so he could take the photos during the day, and there was loads of light coming down.
The one on the cover is extraordinary as well. The one on the cover of your book, it is Lu Jin, and it shows a man on some stilts with a very long stick, and he seems to be wearing some kind of, I don't know, tell me about this photograph.
Yeah, so these are the really iconic, famous Arnodin photographs. I mean, I say famous, they're very famous in southwestern France in particular. If you go, they're on the road signs. You know, they're the kind of, they represent the region. So they're such the epitome of the kind of visual culture of the region, because in that period in the 19th century, when sheep farming was still an important part of the local economy, the shepherds use stilts. They look incredibly striking. They stand on the stilts, and apparently they can move very quickly. They could outrun early bicycles. There was a famous bicycle race between shepherds on stilts and bicycles in Paris, I think in the 1890s. Arnodin, obviously, he liked to photograph the shepherds on the stilts because he felt they were deeply traditional. And that photo on the cover is one of his most important informants, and wearing a traditional sheepskin outfit and standing on the stilts on the moorlands.
Yeah, it's a very striking image. So as well as writing books, and I'm sure you're writing articles, you have a blog. And I noticed that one of the articles on your blog just after the publication of this book was about publication sadness. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was, I think I was saying to you before we started the interview that I felt like it took me a long time to get from, this was a PhD project, to get from that PhD project to the final publication. And I'm certainly not, it was no one's fault but my own, shall we say. But the blog post was particularly about that feeling that because I ended up spending so many years on it, I wanted it to be everything. I wanted it to be perfect, and I wanted it to include everything I had to say about the topic. And of course, you know, no book can do that, it turns out. And there are lots of things about it now that if I had another go, I'm sure I would change. It's that kind of, that sense of coming to terms with the real book as it goes out into the world is perhaps not the ideal book in my mind.
Well, I think you're very hard on yourself. I thought it was excellent. Fascinating.
It's very kind of you to say, thank you.
So what are you working on now? What's going to be your next publication sadness?
Oh, yeah, good question. So at the moment, I have a big research project, which is about witchcraft in France from 1790 to 1940. So the long 19th century, that period of witchcraft history, which people who aren't specialists don't tend to realise there's so much material. So I've got about 1,000 cases. It covers the whole of France. If the Arnodin project was overambitious, then this is getting ridiculous, to be honest. So I've got kind of, 1,000 cases, 150 criminal trial dossiers that I've been working through. And that's the kind of research base. I've got a chapter out about it already. I've got a few more things coming out on that material. But I'm also, at the same time, I'm working on a slightly new methodological direction. So I've been collaborating with quite a few different groups on creative historical practice. So with the witchcraft research, I collaborated with a theatre maker and a poet, and there's poetry out there based on it, and there's a performance piece which we've had to postpone because of coronavirus. But I'm working on a creative non-fiction book based on witchcraft materials. So those are the things I'm interested in at the moment.
Right. So you don't have very much on your plate then?
No, loads of time.
Well, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to me and to tell our listeners about your book, which again is Body and Tradition in 19th Century France, Félix Arnaudin and the Morlands of Gascony, 1870 to 1914. And you are William G. Pooley, or Will Pooley, as I call you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
And just a reminder to our listeners that the New Books in Folklore podcast is one of many channels that you can find on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.